Pre-recorded from Joe's mom's basement, it's a rewind episode of the Stacking Benjamin Show. Hey everyone, I'm Griffin the intern, or as the ladies in my fourth period call me, the Finturn. I don't know if they couldn't trick anyone else into doing this, or if they just like me, but I guess this job is now mine. So, yay me. Anyway, I showed up to the basement about a half an hour ago. It was freezing cold down here, and I didn't even bring a jacket. So I started to look around, and finally found the heater. I went to turn it on, and sitting on top of it was a chocolate chip cookie. A flash drive and a sticky note were taped to the cookie that read, "You passed the first test. You're one smart cookie." From Joe. He's so hilarious. I'll bet he amazes his family with that whole pull my finger trick at the holiday get-togethers too. On the flash drive was episode 221 of the Stacking Benjamin Show, featuring time management secrets from journalist Laura Vanderkam. This was her second appearance on the show, and she always has great advice about making the most of your time. On this show, she's just released a book called I Know How She Does It, which discusses strategies for people who want to work fewer hours, people who want to work more, and people who want more family time. How can you have it all? Laura has some surprising analogies involving strawberries, Legos, and murals on today's show. That's not all. The evil HR lady, Suzanne Lucas, has some advice for people starting a new job and wanting to take vacation this summer. How do you have both? She'll explain. Joe and OG have headlines about tech firms and banking. Who do you trust more? And new legislation we've discussed in the past about 401k oversight rules in the USA. We also take your letters and more. And one more thing before I press play on this episode. Remember that if these two guys talk about investments, this originally aired July 1st, 2015, a Wednesday, and looking at this basement, they probably weren't giving any good advice back then either. So don't make any investment moves or try to take part in any contests, unless the advice is to leave the basement quickly, because trust me, that's some great advice. Finturn out.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have a big show, a real big shoe.
On today's podcast, you know, you only have so much time in your day after what? The nap, little Xbox, maybe some serious thinking about maybe getting something done. How do you manage all your priorities? The one and only Laura Vanderkam knows. The best-selling author studied successful women to see how they juggle busy lives and has tips, not just for women, but for men and women to better use your time. And she's sharing the secrets from her book entitled, I Know How She Does It. She's sharing those in the basement with us today. Live from my parents' basement in Texarkana, Texas, it's the Stacking Benjamin Show. Hey, everybody, I'm Joe Salci. Hi, Average Joe Money on Twitter, and we've got delicious time management strategies for you today. Mom's got Mellow Yellow and Moon Pies out. You got your earbuds in, and we're at the folding table ready to talk all things money. Also on today's show, as if Laura Vanderkam's not enough, news about tech firms and banks. Which do people trust more? And that legislation we talked about before to have more retirement fund oversight. We have an update, that, your letters, and more on today's show. And here he is, the guy who's the original Mellow Yellow, the one and only OG.
I am pretty mellow, are I not?
It depends on the day. You go from super mellow to super not mellow. They're like, is no middle.
I don't do transitional material. That was like a great line from George Carlin. I was
just tell the joke.
Carlin show. Like he went from one dirty joke and then like went to a completely different topic, dirty joke. And then just said, I don't do transitional material. That's me. I have a really long, long green area. Like I can take up a lot of crap. When that fuse gets lit, kaboom.
You and I have a long history of just trying on purpose to light each other's fuse.
Yeah, did I do a good job yesterday?
No.
No, hey, I didn't?
Actually, I didn't, but 2 days ago. 2 days ago, yes. 2 days ago was good. So that is fun. You know what else is fun? Probably more fun than trying to light somebody's fuse is heading to Stacking Benjamins, and probably more worthwhile with your time, heading to stackingbenjamins.com/magnify money, because Nick and the team over at Magnify Money, they've set up this awesome website that will help you look at the best checking accounts, savings accounts, and credit cards out there. I mean, savings accounts right now are paying well less than 1%. If you're earning less than 1%, there are savings accounts that are much, much better for your emergency fund. head to stackingbenjamins.com/magnify money. What's cool is you won't have to give them any information before they give you the results. You know, a lot of these sites that say, hey, we'll do all this work for you. And then you got to give them your social security number, where you live, submit to being tortured, all this stuff. None of that. Just what are you trying to achieve? I want a better savings account. Boom. Magnifymoney.com shows you. So head to stackingbenjamins.com/magnify money. And if you're somebody that has a great credit score, but you've got some debt to take care of, maybe you just graduated from school and it's time to refinance the student loans, SoFi at stackingbenjamins.com/SoFi is your number one place to go. Whether it's student loans, listen to this, rates below 2%. Head to stackingbenjamins.com/SoFi, S-O-F-I, to check it out. Your rate is going to depend on your credit score. And as I mentioned earlier, if you've got a great credit score, Dan Macklin over there at SoFi OG, he says you should have a credit score of at least 725 to apply. So head to stackingbenjamins.com/SoFi if you're looking for a better rate than you can get, that all the riffraff with a lesser credit score gets. You can also do, by the way, personal loans to get your debt refinanced while you're doing the payoff strategy, refinance the house, whatever it might be. stackingbenjamins.com/SoFi. Big 1-2 punch with our sponsors on the show. And one woman who's a 1-2 punch on her own, OG, Laura Vanderkam is here. Laura Vanderkam, who she's often seen, she's all over the place. She's been in Fast Company lately. She wrote for USA Today. She's a best-selling author with What Successful People Do Before Breakfast and Do on the Weekends. We talked to her about those topics last time she was on. So Laura Vanderkam coming back to the basement. But first, we've got headlines.
Hello, darlings. And now it's time for your favorite part of the show, our Stacking Benjamin's headlines.
Short article here from Forbes and Neil McCarthy. We'll have links to these on the show notes at stackingbenjamins.com. Americans trust tech firms more than banks for their finance. Trust levels in America's financial institutions have plummeted over the past couple of years, says a recent Gallup poll, showing a mere 28% of people in the United States have confidence in the nation's banks. Interestingly, the financial capabilities of America's leading technology companies are now trusted more than the country's biggest banks. So you know how Apple and Google and everybody is getting into mobile payments, OG? People trust Apple to make those mobile payments work, but they don't trust the bank that holds your money.
Yeah, until somebody gets hacked, right? That's probably the reason to say why they trust them more, just tired of their bull crap.
No, this is a very short, very, very...
Just says that they do.
Yeah, just a... Yeah.
Well, I'll guess then. The reason is because... Let me see here. Because everybody likes Apple logo and their website way better.
Well, Apple and Google have very popular brands.
Sure.
Number one, so people think they can't do much wrong. And second, being in tech, they hope that they would have good security measures, right? But banks also have great security measures. You know what, though? Banks have done this to them. I don't think this says positive stuff about tech firms. I think it's just another indictment on banks and why all these fintech startups are getting so much leverage, because banks aren't doing it. Banks have a vested interest in the status quo, right? Where when we talked about banks of the future a couple months ago on the show, you know, banks have a vested interest not to change. And it's these smaller regional banks now and these fintech firms that are starting to steal big banks' lunch.
Well, that's the experience that I had even just going through the mortgage process. You know, we got too far down a field and too far in the process to change horses midstream. But there was a time when I was ready to just pull the thing on everything because it was so beaten down in bureaucracy. And all I could think was, there's got to be a tech firm, a mortgage company that's internet-based that would have had this done by now. I mean, it took 45 days for the local credit union to get done. Now, we got it done. It was a favorable rate. Everything ended up good. But the process was so bad. And I think that's what you're seeing. I think that people are okay with the outcome at the bank, right? I'm okay that my checking account works when I want it to work. My savings account works when I want it to work. The payments work, but I don't like the process going into it.
Getting
it
there.
Look at like Apple, you know, I'm a little bit of an Apple geek now. And I think last week we mentioned that I might have acquired an Apple Watch and monkeyed with it a little bit, but I've just been wearing it as a watch. We went and saw the movie that we talked about on Monday, Inside Out. And I walk into the theater and my watch goes, and I look down and it says, you're at the movie theater. Here are your tickets. Because I bought them on Fandango, right? Walked up, the guy looks at me and says, you got your tickets? I said, I think this counts, right? And he just looked, he goes, huh, yeah, look at that. Beep, printed, scanned, done. And I go, no, I didn't have to reach for my wallet. I didn't have to pull up my driver's license. And what credit card did you use? They just make it work.
It seems like banks had an opportunity to do that and said no. Remember the whole thing about how we heard a long time ago that South Korea, as an example, had mobile payments. We were talking about this 3 and 4 years ago, that mobile payments have been there forever. And banks were the ones that said, and we had headlines about, they thought American consumers were too stupid to get it done. So right. Who ends up jumping on it? Apple, Google, banks let it go.
I'll give you another example. I was at our local, we call it an arboretum, like a place where there's trees and flowers and you go take pictures and that sort of thing. And we're walking around. It's 178 degrees Kelvin outside. And there's the Coke machine. And I'm thinking, oh, crap, I don't have any dollars. You know, who carries singles with them? You know, I mean, you might have a 5 or a 10, but a lot of times, I mean, bingo, contactless payments. They get the iPhone, you know, pay by phone thing there.
Really?
A little scan. Yeah. So you hold your phone up there, Apple Pay.
On the Coke machine.
On the Coke machine. You just press the button. You can do 3 at a time. So I can go, you know, bottle water, bottle water, bottle water. It goes transaction complete. You know, my phone vibrates. You just bought $4 worth of water. Hold it up. Bottle water, bottle water, bottle water. Everybody's got bottle water. It took 25 seconds. I wasn't fishing dollar, like trying to straighten out the dollar. Man. But it works. That's the difference between the bank and Apple or Google or tech firms, is that when you go to Amazon or when you go to Google or when you buy something, it works exactly with the way you want it. And you're not mired in the details of the how's the sausage is being made.
You can get on with all the stuff you really want to do.
Yeah. It's the same level of transactions. I mean, you go on Amazon, look at your order history and see how much money you've spent on Amazon. You spend as much on Amazon probably as you spend at the grocery store.
Right.
But you can go, hey, can I get $800 out of my account? You know, like if you're going to buy something, a big expense. On Amazon, you can buy it and it'll be in your house in 2 days. You want to go buy $800 out of the bank. I need your driver's license, your check card. When was the last transaction you made? I need to verify your identity. You know, it's going to take 3 to 5 business days to process that, sir. You know, you're like, dude, I just go to Amazon. I get that stuff in my account tomorrow.
Right. You ordered a ladder on Amazon.
I did, and I just got it out of the box. It was fantastic.
Yeah, that is crazy. But you know what? As those become better, it is more important for all of us to use these mobile budgeting apps because, you know, I remember even just using the, I'm not using Apple Pay yet, but I remember being at Disney, you know, and having that magic band where it magically took money out of my account.
No, it magically added it to your bill.
Right.
That's like, I think I told that story when we were at Disney last time and my father-in-law says, what if I want to get like a Coke, you know, because you said I don't have to bring my wallet or anything. I'm like, no, just hold the magic band up. He goes, what if I want to get like, you know, like a pack of gum or something, which obviously there's no gum, but, you know, or a cup of coffee or buy lunch. Or yeah. I'm like, oh, just magic band, get a cocktail, magic band. And he sits there for a second. He goes, who pays the magic bands?
Walt does.
That's the surprise at the end of your trip. Right. The last night they slide that manila envelope under. If it's like me, they like have to open the door and let set it inside.
Because there's not enough room.
It's not thick enough to slide underneath. They're thin enough to slide underneath the door.
That's great. Yeah, that's all right. Using those budgeting apps is going to be more important than ever because money's going to slide out of your account. Sometimes friction is good, right? Frictionless transactions. Second article, we don't have to spend a lot of time on this. This is from NAPANET, National Association of Plan Advisors, the people that do 401k plans. Senate Appropriations Bill targets fiduciary proposal. Remember how we talked about last month, this big thing going through the Senate about 401k plans and IRAs, OG, and how that was going to be more oversight. The Department of Labor was looking for more oversight of retirement plans. It appears it's going to pass, and it also appears that it's not going to get funded. This is the way the Senate works. They agree to pass it, so in theory, it's good, but then they stripped it of all the money to make sure that it can't get implemented.
There you go.
So, yeah. So they were for it before they were against it. Wasn't that some campaign slogan at some point? You can straddle a line there. So the lessons today, the government decides to do nothing again. Not that that's good or bad, because we talked about might not be great legislation anyway, OG. Mm-hmm. But the government passes it, but doesn't pass it. And then the second is tech firms, maybe not your best choice, maybe not your number one choice, but clearly, again, banks prove that they're not to be trusted. big time management guy.
I've been known to dabble.
So what's some of the best stuff you've learned from past Laura Vanderkam books?
I'm a big fan of like trying to do things, and I think it was her that talked about this, trying to do things when your energy level is at the right spot, you know? So like when the after lunch, can't tell if it's time for more coffee or to start whiskey that time. It's later in the afternoon.
I'm sure that's the way she defines it too.
Yeah. I try to do emails at that time. You know, brainless, like reply to emails. Not a lot of research, not a lot of project stuff. Just mellow things as I coast into that quasi-hypnotic state between the coffee's going off and the whiskey's about to start.
I love that too. I love the fact that she looks at energy as if it's like a vial. And you do two things. You exercise to try to increase the vial, right? To give yourself more energy. But then secondly, you look at when the vial's most full for you. And some people are night owls, but me, like Laura, who said that she's a first thing in the morning kind of person, that is totally me. Get the toughest stuff done at the beginning of the day because that's when I have the most energy. I have the most brain power. I always try to do the creative stuff then. But we're going to get more from her today. Can't wait to hear what she's got for us because she has a new book out, which is called I Know How She Does It, where she profiles some of the most successful women in the workplace to see how they juggle so many different things. Let's say hello. Laura Vanderkam coming down to the basement. And Laura Vanderkam joins us in the basement. Welcome back, Laura.
Thank you for having me back here.
Well, now, I noticed, and I know how she does it, that there were no tips about working from a basement. I would think that that would be the biggest key to success out there.
I think some people have probably done it. There were a few people who work from home occasionally, so I'm guessing the basement played a role there too.
Right. Thanks for placating us. You know what's funny is that Farnoosh and I were talking last week about how just unbelievably funny you are. And it's funny because Farnoosh and I said, both of us, that funny isn't a word that people initially say when it comes to Laura Vanderkam, but she and I both think you're hilarious.
Well, that's good. I mean, I've been called many things. People have a certain assumption if you write about time management that you are kind of a taskmaster. You are into planning every minute, sort of a joyless march through life. And I really don't see it that way. So I'm glad that comes across.
You definitely don't. I'm glad that there's somebody out there who's not just telling me I need to do more. But what's cool is you cover doing more if you want to. But I think my biggest takeaway from the book is successful people don't have to work more hours.
No, they don't. You know, often there's ways that you can repurpose hours you are currently allegedly working to turn them into slightly more efficient and productive hours, and which means that you can work more without actually working more, right? That if you repurpose hours, they can move you toward your goals better than they currently are. But the good news is even people who are already very successful, many have reasonably balanced lives. In this book, I did a time diary study of 1,001 days in the lives of women who were earning six figures and who happened to also have families. And they were working longer than average, but they weren't working around the clock. They were working about 44 hours a week on average. And I found that a very heartening number because, you know, it could have been 60, it could have been 80, who knows? But in fact, they were keeping it under control.
Yeah, we live in the society, I love you said, in finance and in some other areas like finance, maybe attorneys, where it's cool to brag about your hours and how many huge hours you work, but you didn't find that to be the case at all.
No, I mean, and some of the women I interviewed themselves would tell me about their 60-hour work weeks and their time log would be 42. And I'd say, well, that's interesting. I mean, you know, maybe this was an atypical week, but there'd have to be a lot of much longer weeks to get it to average out to that. But I think we just have certain impressions of our work weeks, partly because most people don't know there's 168 hours in a week, so they don't know what proportion they're working, and it feels like they're working a lot, you know, especially if work is stressful or taxing in some way. And so we have a tendency to assume it takes more hours than it actually does.
I get most of my best ideas when I'm out running and I don't expect to have an idea, right? I'm watching the side of the road. I'm thinking about my heart rate. Maybe I'm listening to a podcast. Your idea for this whole book, I love how you start this book. It started someplace mundane also, which is in a strawberry field.
Yeah. I mean, that wasn't where I actually got the idea for the book. It was certainly coming up with some of the metaphors for the book there. But in the strawberry field, I was just walking along and I look at this basket that our pick your own farm hands us. And it's got this phrase on it, which is, remember the berry season is short. I'm like, wow. Yeah, that was kind of a profound moment sitting here in this tractor with my whining children, that the berry season is short and it's basically over now here in the East Coast. You get the last days of May, the first days of June. The strawberries are amazing for 2 weeks and then they are done. And if you don't seize those 2 weeks to go out and pick them, then you will not be doing strawberry picking this year. And I think there's a metaphor for that and what I was trying to convey in my own thoughts about this book. I mean, I have somewhat of a packed life right now of writing and promoting my books while I'm also raising 4 children who are just 8 and under. And so sometimes it does seem that life is a little intense, but it's the berry season, right? It won't always be like this. And the berry season is short. So I believe in eating as many berries as you can.
What a great analogy. I also love the fact that, you know, when you talked about the women that you surveyed who filled out these timesheets, I've done that before, Laura. And how many people tell you they hate that, by the way?
A reasonable number. I've had lawyers downright refuse to do it. They're like, if I have to track my personal time, like my work time, I will just go jump off a cliff.
Yeah, I thought that. But then you said, you know, it really isn't filling in boxes. It's more like a mosaic. And this idea of a mosaic resonates through your whole book.
Yeah. So, I mean, you can look at a time log a couple of ways. And the one that I had most people fill out is Excel. It's slightly souped up Excel, which Excel is possibly the dreariest concept out there. There is nothing exciting about a spreadsheet. And so some people really have a problem with this idea of kind of shoehorning life into cells on a grid. And I get that because I have a problem with shoehorning life into cells on a grid. But then you could twist that a little and say, well, what if we view this as a mosaic, right? These cells on the grid are actually tiles in a mosaic. And we are the mosaic makers, deciding how we will place those tiles, deciding what we want the mosaic of our lives to look like hour by hour. And I think that that is a much more artistic and creative idea. And if you view it that way, then maybe it'll be slightly more exciting to fill it out.
It reminds me of the play Rent, you know, 525,600 minutes.
Which is true. If you do the math, my cells had, it was 336 on the charts. I did it half hour by half hour. And, you know, with 1,001 days, that was 48,048 little cells, I guess. So there were a lot of them, some profound insights into life.
You go over all kinds of tips. I mean, everything from juggling family responsibilities to people that want to work more, people that want to work less. And it seems like it's really more about being intentional with your time than anything else.
It is. I think that is really the secret to success. Life is lived in hours. And so what we do will be a function of how we spend those hours. And so choosing how to spend those hours with a goal of making them meaningful and enjoyable for ourselves and those we care about vastly increases the chances that those things actually happen.
Can we go through a couple of the stories in the book? Because I love your stories and I think we all learn from other people. I like the early story about the Clifford Chance associate with the 2 young children, had an awful day in the middle of the night, gets woken up by the kids, has a colleague who sits on a note until daycare was closing. I've had that happen to me before too. I'm like, come on, I gotta go. And my colleague has no idea.
No idea. Yeah, that was a fascinating story that I had found. It kind of set the blogosphere on fire for a while because this particular woman decided to quit her job by sending a note to all her colleagues detailing hour by hour this incredibly awful day. And so it was like my genre of literature, the time log, only turned into a departure memo. And I found it fascinating because it so fit this narrative we have of like these stressful, awful things happened, and therefore I must quit, right? I have reached an epiphany that therefore I must quit. And so much of the literature on women and work and life takes this form. That's one epiphany we could have for that. And certainly this was a really crappy day. Like, let's not find it. Like, it was a crappy day. But there are many other conclusions we could draw from a crappy day. We could draw the conclusion that I had a crappy day. I mean, such is the human condition. We are not promised a string of blissful days. The second conclusion is that I could maybe make some changes at work, right? You know, maybe I need a different job. Maybe I need a different setup in my current job, which I could negotiate for in some way, shape, or form. Maybe the conclusion is that I need more help at home. You know, this woman was using daycare, which can be a great option, but sometimes is a little bit less flexible than people who have in-home care from a nanny. So maybe that would be something she needed instead. Maybe the conclusion is that she needed more support from her spouse. That's another conclusion we could draw. I mean, there's just a million things you could have also concluded from this crappy day. And yet those don't fit the narrative that we put on women with big jobs, that this is unsustainable. You cannot have it all. The Greek chorus is chanting this. You cannot have it all. Don't you even try. And so when we have that in the back of our heads, the epiphany it leads us to is that you cannot do this. You must quit.
And man, you go through about 5 billion ways that this woman and any woman and actually men can handle their day. Like if somebody wants to cut their hours but stay productive, what are some of the key tips that will help somebody cut back some of those hours at work and still get a lot done?
Well, I think the first thing you need to do is look at how you're spending your time now. I mean, I always recommend that people keep track of their time if they want to spend it better. We tend to treat meetings with a reverence that they don't always deserve. So the easiest way to save an hour a day is to look at your calendar and find one meeting where you don't think you add enough value to justify your presence. And if you can do that, if you can cancel a meeting that doesn't seem worthwhile, like, wow, you just found yourself an hour. How exciting is that? You know, we spend way too much time in our inboxes. Not every email needs to be answered. If you are sitting there responding to everything that comes in, you will spend your whole day doing it. You will find yourself at 4:30 being like, oh my goodness, I didn't get to the stuff that I needed to get to for tomorrow morning, which just buys you a late night. So don't do that. Do that stuff that needs to be done earlier in the day, like perform a triage at 3 o'clock or so and make sure that everything that needs to get done is actually getting done. The email will always be there and you will never reach the bottom of your inbox. So you may as well give up trying. And another way is to actually, somewhat paradoxically, take real breaks during your day. Because if you don't take real breaks, you take fake ones. And by fake ones, I mean that somewhere around 2 p.m., if you've eaten lunch at your desk, you will find yourself realizing that you've been following links from Twitter for the past 30 minutes and you have no idea what you did with that time. You're just completely unfocused, unable to make yourself work. And it's because your brain is rebelling. It does not want to stay focused. And so it has taken a break. But the problem is that this break is not actually rejuvenating in the way that getting up from your desk and getting a real lunch or getting up and going for a walk or, you know, meeting a colleague for coffee, all of those would be much better ways to spend that time. And then, you know, you'd get your work done and get out on time.
I don't do yet lots of the things that you say in your book, which is what I love because I'm making notes as I'm reading it about all the things that I want to be more intentional about. But I love the 4 p.m. triage thing, Laura, is something that I've been doing for most of my career where I get to 4 o'clock and I just think, who's actually getting on this helicopter out of town, right?
Yeah, a lot of stuff can wait. I mean, it might help to pretend that like some evil villain is going to steal your laptop and your cell phone at 5 p.m. And if that was going to happen, you know, what would you actually do before then? And what would you be like, you know, I'll let him have it.
Well, and for me, that triage is so important because your fifth chapter in the book hit me really hard, which is the header of the chapter is just be there, which is, I know so many people who, you know, you go out to dinner. I go out to dinner with my family and I'll look over at the next table and everybody's sitting together, but they're all on their phone, right? Nobody's actually there.
Yes, I guess the people who are on the phone are more interesting than the actual human beings that you're sitting with. I think that time is easy to use mindlessly, and it is more easy to be mindless about our personal and leisure time than it is about work time because we have at least some sense of accountability at the office for hours. So the be there idea is really about being mindful of your family and leisure time and actually treating that time with the same respect that you would work. And I don't mean that you need to plan every 15 minutes and, you know, send calendar invites for dinner and all those things. But having an idea that if you know you have 4 hours between after you get home from work and go to bed, well, 4 hours is quite a bit of time. Like, what would you like to do with it? You might say, I'd like to do nothing, but you can't actually do nothing. You'll do something, but it will probably be something that is not particularly meaningful or enjoyable to you or the people you care about. So just having an idea, saying, well, maybe we'll try this new recipe as a family tonight, or we'll go for a walk after dinner, or we're going to play a board game, helps you at least think of this ahead of time. And that way you won't come in the door exhausted and unable to sort of motivate yourself to use that time.
Yeah, you said that lots of people say they have meals together, but then really when you looked at the numbers, not that many people actually do.
Yeah, it's one of these funny things with surveys about people. Whenever something is socially desirable, people claim to do it a lot more often than they actually do. It's just human nature. So vast chunks of Americans claim to have family dinner nightly. There was a study that was done in UCLA that was an anthropological study. They installed cameras in a bunch of, you know, dual income families' houses and noticed that, let's just say, people were not all sitting down at the dinner table together. You know, a family dinner was sort of a sequence where there's a meal, but like kids whine for something different. And then they go grab their chicken nuggets and eat it in front of the TV. And like another person wanders off and like, it's not a dinner, right? And sometimes that's just the way it is. But one suggestion I had in the book is that if family dinner is hard to make work, you know, you have bad schedules in the evenings and everything's a little hectic, you know, do family breakfast instead. It's a time you might be able to have, and little kids wake up at the crack of dawn anyway, so you may as well use that time.
I love the woman in the book who carved out 2 hours of Lego time. And I also loved what you said in the book, that your brain just doesn't work that way for 2 hours.
It does not. More power to her, but she was an engineer, so she had a leg up on that one.
We talked about people who want to work less, but you also cover people that want to work more. And I love the advice to think in terms of weeks instead of in days. That alone, I think, is a huge idea that most of us don't get.
Yeah. So, I mean, this may sound crazy that there are people who want to work more, but many of us who do have lots of responsibilities in our personal lives sometimes struggle to put in enough hours to advance our careers. And while we can all be more efficient on some level, you know, at some point it is a question of hours, and you need to not only do the work in front of you, but build in time to think about the future and to network and those important things. So I was talking about, you know, how you can work longer hours if you want to. And one way is to think in terms of 168 hours rather than 24, because when people only view the life as in 24 hours, they get frustrated because all the things we want to do cannot, in fact, fit within 24 hours. And so people are like, well, I can't put in a full day of work and network and hang out with my kids and go to the gym and see my friends and get a full night's sleep. And well, of course, yes, you cannot do all those things in 24 hours. But if you look at all 168 hours of the week, then you probably can. You know, you could go to one networking event for work, or maybe work really late one night and yet still be home the vast majority of nights. And maybe one evening you go to the gym. Well, you're still home the vast majority of nights, but you fit these things into your life. So by looking at the whole week, we see possibilities, whereas looking at just 24 hours tends to limit our frame.
Yeah, because that's when, to me, batching tasks then comes in, right? I can fill my Monday with all the really productive things because Monday's a great day for me. And on Friday, when my brain is wandering, I can do things like planning my next week.
That's a great idea. And planning the week before you're in it was another common tactic of successful people. Because, you know, when you do hit Monday, as you do, ready to go, it's game time, you have this huge burst of energy and focus. You want to make sure you're devoting that to the right thing. So planning your week before you're in it, make sure you start Monday on the right tasks.
Last time you and I spoke, we were talking about what successful people do on their weekend, how they treat the weekend differently than a lot of other people do. And you talked then about Sundays and about the importance of maybe spending an hour on Sunday planning your day. But then you talked to David Allen, who we love, the getting things done guy, and you said he changed your mind.
Yeah. So I used to do this mostly on Sunday night, planning the week ahead. And he casually mentioned when I was interviewing him for something that a lot of his clients did their planning on Fridays. And I was like, oh, that's an interesting idea. And the more I think about it, the more brilliant it is, because Friday afternoon for me is generally a dead time. You know, I'm not willing to start anything new, but I'm willing to think about what future me should be doing. So the opportunity cost of this planning time is pretty low. But the other upside is that if I think about what I need to do and I realize, oh, I need to talk to X, Y, or Z person next week, well, I can send them a note and chances are they're still at their desks so they can respond and we could get it scheduled. And I'll know where that goes in the week before the week starts. And the other great thing about doing it on Friday is then you have a plan for Monday. And because you have a plan for Monday, you don't have to think about it as much on the weekend. And one thing that makes people have trouble relaxing on the weekend is that they are thinking about, what am I supposed to be doing on Monday? And if you know what you're supposed to be doing on Monday by the time you leave the office on Friday, then you can relax a little bit more.
You reference Sheryl Sandberg's book, Lean In, quite a bit in your book. Did that book change the conversation, Laura?
I think it did. I'm very grateful to Sheryl Sandberg for bringing up many of the issues she did. I think that I hope my book is a complement to that, that people might consider reading it too, as sort of the nuts and bolts of how people build a life that works. She makes a great point of young women thinking that the big job is one that won't allow them work-life balance. Whereas I think, in fact, and she points this out, the big job is the one that will allow you work-life balance because you'll have more control of your time, more autonomy. It'll be probably more interesting work, and you'll have the resources to afford help. So it's really tragic that we tell young women that, oh, you need sort of a less intense job if you want to have a family, where, you know, when it turns out that the less intense, lower paying job is the one that's going to push you out of the workforce because it won't be able to compete with the amazing things going on at home. And you won't be able to make that choice because you won't be able to control your time and you won't be able to afford the help you need.
The book is called I Know How She Does It, and I absolutely loved it, Laura. And I assume it's available everywhere?
It's available everywhere, all major retailers. And yeah, it's written about successful women, but I hope that your listeners will consider reading it, even if they are men, because it has strategies for anyone who wants to live a full life, who wants to be fully invested in building a career and raising a family too. And just as a side note, the cover isn't pink, so you can be seen walking around with it. It's actually somewhat masculine looking blue.
It is guy friendly.
It is guy friendly.
Well, I didn't even get to some of my favorite stories. I think my favorite one, and we won't even talk about it because this will just entice people to read it. I love Lisa Camuso Miller, the former communications director for the Republican National Committee. The things that she did when I was doing media, and actually even today with the podcast, are some of those strategies or strategies I use every day to try to just keep up with people. And they're fantastic stories. If there's one misconception people have about time management, that for all the work that you've done, I mean, you've done so many articles, so many pieces, so many tomes on controlling your time. There's got to be something that you get when you go to a bookstore and you're talking about your work that's like nails on a chalkboard. What would that be?
I think that getting back to this idea of time management as being such a dreary, formulaic, no fun way to go through life, and that keeping track of your time would be just this dreary thing to do. And I think partly people get that idea because they think it's going to show how much time they're wasting, which it may. But I think in many cases, it shows us what's going right with our life. It shows us where there may be space for us to do things we would love to do with our lives. So in that case, it's actually liberating. I had many people who kept time logs for this book tell me, you know, I used to feel guilty about whatever it is, and I don't feel guilty anymore because looking at their time logs, they can see they were actually doing whatever it is that they thought they never did. So I think that it's a empowering way to look at our lives, not a punitive way to look at our lives.
Hey, all you raging out of control trivia peeps, Debonair Doug here. I'm just reading some fan mail I stole out of Joe's mailbox. Thank you for all the kind words. It never gets old. Here's a letter right here. Jody from Vicksburg writes, Dear Joe, that Doug who does trivia, now why do you keep him around? I know what you're saying, Jody. I'm way better than these amateurs, and if I were Joe, I wouldn't want anybody to make me look bad either. Sure, I've considered starting the Doug Trivia Power Hour. My agent keeps telling me the market isn't quite ready for my bleeding edge humor. So if you've got a Broadway connection, let's just say I'm all ears. But I have a job to do and I'm nothing if not the consummate professional, so here we go with this week's trivia. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, what percentage of people over the age of 25 have a high school diploma in the USA? Well, we'll have the answer right after Evil HR Lady schools us. Oh my God, it's just so easy when you're as talented as I am. Fish in a barrel, people. Fish in a barrel.
What evil lurks in your human resources department? Here comes the evil HR lady herself, Suzanne Lucas.
And Suzanne Lucas, the evil HR lady, joins us. Welcome back to the basement.
Thank you. It's good to be here where it's dark and cold.
Where did you park the broom? That's what everybody wants to know. Where does she park the broom when she flies in from Switzerland?
Ha ha, ha ha ha.
All right, fine. Well, let's get serious for a second because we're in the middle of summer, Suzanne, as you know, and everybody wants a vacation. But let's say that you just started the job, right? You got this brand new job, but I really want to take a break. How do you do that?
Well, if you're starting a new job, you need to ask for vacation during that salary negotiation phase after they've made the offer and before you've accepted.
So they know ahead of time when you come in for day number one that you're already taking X day off.
Right. And that way it also gives them the chance to say, no, sorry, that won't work for us. And then you can decide, well, do I want this job badly enough to skip this vacation or should I not take this job and go on my vacation?
Yeah, and there's different types of things that you talk about. And actually, you wrote a great article about this about money. I'll have this in the show notes at stackingbenjamins.com. But first is planning in advance. We talked about that. What about the standard summer vacation?
Well, generally, people expect you to take a summer vacation because that's kind of culturally what we do. But you might not want to do that if you're starting, today or last week. And you normally go spend a week with grandma, you might want to push that off for a later date. And you don't want to get your boss thinking that you're more concerned about vacation time than working time. So if it's not something critical, like if it's your sister getting married, that's critical and you need to talk about that. But if it's just a standard vacation, you might want to put that off.
So the first year, you might have to let that trip to the amusement park go.
Right.
Man, what a bummer. You're not full
of
good.
We're going Saturday with the rest of the world.
Yeah, that's right. Stand in the longer line. But you're right. For your first year, I mean, you got to think of it as working your way up the ladder, I would think.
You do. And it's not only working your way up the ladder, but there's always a learning curve for any job. And it's usually pretty steep at the beginning. Now, one thing about summer, though, is that if all of your coworkers are gone, you might as well be gone, too, because you don't know how to do anything.
But does that also, if a lot of your coworkers are gone in the summer, it seems to me, just talking about strategy of getting to know people in the workplace, it seems like it's probably easier to get to know a few employees. Like for me, I'm lost at a big party, but at a small party with just a few people, I can get to know people pretty well.
Yeah, I guess you could take advantage of that. If there's only five people around, you can really get to know people and learn a little bit more about what they do, which is very helpful in any job.
Yeah. So my daughter has a summer job and really, really, really wanted to take a vacation this year. She actually did what you said, which is said, okay, I will just sacrifice and not do it because she wants to get hired back next year. But if you've got a summer job, what do you do?
Well, it depends on what kind of a summer job it is. If you're working, let's say, at that amusement park that is only open during the summer, your boss is not going to be really thrilled about you taking off. The reason they hired you is because they need people there. If you're working at Burger King and you're only putting in 15 or 20 hours a week, it's pretty easy to get your boss to let you have time off, especially if you're willing to take weekdays and work the weekend instead, or say, I'll work every Friday night if I can have Monday through Thursday off this week or something like that. You can negotiate much more on a part-time job just because you're not expected to be there all of the time.
Yeah, Cheryl, in her job, she takes the holidays off every year. But because of that, she kind of feels like it's like a two for one. So she lets other people take off the 4th of July and Labor Day. Like she covers for them on those weekends so that she gets it off. It seems like there's some trading you can probably do too.
Yeah, there is. There's definitely trading. And like I said, with a part-time job, usually your coworkers want to get more hours too, and you can move things around pretty easily. For a full-time summer job, though, it's generally something that's really tourist heavy and they want you there. That's going to be harder.
Right. Well, so tell me, where do people read more?
They can read more at humanresources.about.com. Yep. To learn about vacations.
And I'll have that in the show notes. And your website, what's going on over there at the Evil HR Lady?
Well, lots of things are going over at the Evil HR Lady. You can learn about bad bosses and bad behavior at the office if you come to www.evilhrlady.org.
I love some of those train wreck stories.
I know, me too.
We'll see you soon.
All right.
Okay, trivia lovers, I'm back, and I've got the answer to this week's trivia in the hand that isn't holding my foamy beverage. Here's the question again. What percentage of people age 25 and over in the USA have a high school diploma? The answer, 86%.
I'm so thankful we have two great sponsors for the Stacking Benjamins podcast. Our first one is Magnify Money. They've been a longtime sponsor of our show, as many of you know. And if you head to stackingbenjamins.com/magnify money, like many of you have, you'll know why. And what I love about them is that Nick Clements, the CEO at Magnify Money, tells people that you can use the surfing strategy. So if you go to magnifymoney.com and you take a look at the credit card area, you'll see that there are some credit cards that will give you 0% interest for a short period of time. Well, if you use that, we call that surfing in financial planning. You surf down to a 0% interest rate, and then when your interest rate starts to come back up, you surf to a different card. Nick Clements says that's a great strategy, but it also has some pitfalls.
It's painful if you stay around when the promotional period is over, but it's actually really, really easy to move the debt when you're done. So it's more laziness that gets people stuck in the balance transfer than anything else. Banks are betting on laziness.
That's a tagline right there. So whether you're comparing your checking account, savings account, or your credit cards, head to stackingbenjamins.com and surf safely. Don't be lazy. And here's the transition. How about this? First time I heard about SoFi, our other sponsor, was from Nick. Nick, who you just heard from magnifymoney.com. And the reason was, he said the SoFi was awesome. So I looked into him, and guess what? Not only were they awesome, they decided to become our sponsor. I asked Dan Macklin how hard the process is when it comes to getting a loan from SoFi.
It's really easy. You go to SoFi.com and apply. It takes about 10 minutes. We ask for a few pieces of information, and then we will approve you or not approve you instantly in the vast majority of cases. So within 10 minutes, you'll know if you have a rate, what that rate is, and we'll show you calculations as to how much money you can save. So it's extremely quick and simple.
Easy process, great people, and Nick at Magnify Money loves them. How great's that? Head to stackingbenjamins.com/SoFi, S-O-F-I, and that'll tell Dan and the team over there at SoFi that we sent you. And if the sponsor ain't happy, ain't nobody happy, right? We get letters. OG, Doug just brought down the mail. We got a couple good ones today. Where you're going to love these. First letter comes from Brian. Brian said, Joe, I want to pick your brain about your previous financial advisory experience. I thought we'd bring you into this one too, OG. I'm going through a bit of a career transition. He's looking to do something on the personal finance side, CFP or advisor, just trying to talk to as many people as he can to get advice, opinions, and would love to hear our thoughts about breaking in as a CFP or an advisor. We've had this question a couple times from people before, but we're always happy to talk about it again. The big thing from where I sit, there is a big moat to get across when you begin your career. And that's the first thing to realize is that no matter how much experience you have formerly with money, it's going to be difficult for people to trust the new guy. So you have to find people who are going to trust the new guy. That's a tough thing to start. Also, there are ups and downs hit you much harder when you're a brand new advisor, because when you have three clients and one doesn't do what you ask them to do, it's going to hit your pocketbook more than if you have 150 clients, let's say, or 50 clients, or whatever number of clients you have. So as you gain experience, it's better. Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000 hours applies more, I think, to financial advisory practices than anywhere else. Because you get that 10,000 hours of experience in, you finally start also getting consistent paychecks. My first year, I think, as an advisor, I made, I believe, about $85,000.
Which 85 grand?
Yes.
Holy crow.
Yes, which was a nice first year.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Yeah, I had a good first year. But listen, to my second year, I think I made $32,000. And my third year was the year that I've written about extensively, where I had a back charge off. I had this big situation with a client. I made no money all year. I made less than $12,000. And it was only because of and I had a family of four. Cheryl wasn't making any money, had young twins. I was the only one making money, and I made less than $12,000. So there's a big mole, even if you get started off right, like I did.
I was going to say, that bodes pretty well. My experience is the exact opposite of yours. I made 10,000 my first year, 30 my second, and then it grew from there. But once I remember I was past 100, and then I completely redid my practice, like how I build clients and all that sort of stuff. And then that year I made $600.
Right.
It was 600. My wife still reminds me of, do you remember the year that you made 600? Don't do that again.
Yeah.
But yeah, our job is much more of sales and marketing right out the gate for sure than it is on advising people, because you have to find those people to provide said advising advice to. And then you have to convince them that you're the one that would be smart enough, good enough, fast enough, whatever to do it with or whatever.
Around the 5-year mark, it starts getting less bumpy. I had a great experience when I started off, which is different than most. I find most people, when they start off, people trying to lure them to work for their organization lie about what it takes to be successful. Like out and out lie. I have talked to more people that got lied to by companies about what it was going to take to be successful. I felt lucky because I was told point blank, the guy that recruited me brought my wife and I to a dinner, and he didn't even talk to me. He turned to my wife and he said, Cheryl, he's going to be gone for 2 years. The first 2 years, you're not going to see him. And if he really wants to be successful, you're probably not going to see him much for the first 5 years. So are you comfortable letting your husband go for a 5-year period? Because he's just not going to be around. And I like that, because that was totally the truth. After my second year, I decided I was going to work more reasonable hours and my paycheck plummeted, right? I mean, between that and the fact that I also redid my practice, I thought that I was just going to spend more time servicing the clients that had already trusted me with their money instead of trying to get more. You know, I didn't have enough clients to do that. It's a big old moat. However, you know, OG, you've seen these stats that show why people love being a financial advisor. Once you swim that moat, it's a fantastic job.
Once you get past it, it's wonderful. I mean, I don't hide the fact from my clients or my family. I don't work Fridays ever under any circumstances. If you call my office number, it says we're open from this time to this time, closed on Fridays. I take probably, what would you say, 12 weeks of vacation a year, 10 weeks of vacation a year, like purposeful times off.
And then when you're going,
I don't necessarily go somewhere for vacation. Let's be clear. I'm not, you know, in Australia 12 weeks out of the year.
Right.
But I shut everything down. So it's a wonderful way, it's a wonderful career to be able to control your own time and energy. I stay at home, I work with my, you know, I take my kids to soccer games. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
But that was I've been doing it almost 20 years now.
Yeah. And then you work some tough hours when you work, and when you don't work, you don't work.
Yeah.
It is. Yeah, absolutely. But the cool thing is you're able to bend your schedule the way that you want it.
20 years from now, you too can be just like me.
Thanks to Brian for the question. If you've got a question for us, whether it's about becoming a financial advisor, about your money, send those to joe@stackingbenjamins.com. And OG and I are very happy to talk about them on the podcast. We also get reviews, and I'm so thankful for people who give us reviews, because these help us find new listeners. We're not sure how, especially on iTunes, we're not sure how it works. But iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you listen, we zoom up the ratings when you interface with the page. If you rate the show, we get a jump up. If you actually leave a review, it's even more. If you subscribe, it's even more. So we do know that. But so thanks to everybody who's left us a review. And these are two that are going on the refrigerator. First one, 5 stars from Maine Summer One. The summer in Maine. Oh, gee, that sounds like fun. It says, best in his class, maybe create a book club? Good for education and affiliate potential. I'm not sure what the affiliate potential thing means, but the book club is interesting. I think that might be fun. I got to tell you, we had a lot of fun with our Stacking 101 Benjamins class that we just did. We've had a great time. That is in the process of wrapping up right now. We're going to end up with about 24 lessons, 2 live sessions and 24 lessons, and a great interactive close Facebook group. So a book club might be next. I'll tell you what we do have. We do have an app that is going to be used for something that's kind of an inner circle, more audio for people that want even more called The Green Room. You can get the app now. The app, by the way, is pretty awesome, and you don't have to subscribe to The Green Room, and that becomes available to use the app. So if you look up Stacking Benjamins, if you're on iTunes, it's the only app. If you're at the Google Play Store, there's two apps. Make sure that you get the one that's the podcast app. We have another one that's also for the blog. You can listen to the podcast there too, but that one also encompasses the blog. But I'll tell you, the podcast app, great for podcast listening. Anyway, thanks for the review, Main Summer. And if you could leave us a review, please do. That helps us find new listeners. That's it, OG, another show. And unfortunately, today, looking at the time, we are out of time. We're not going to be able to do any movies today. Love to do some movies, but this is going to have to be a little bit of a short show. We are both very, very crunched. This is what happens in the summer every year to the show, OG. Shows get just a little bit shorter, and we've got so many time commitments that we're going to keep them coming out, but this summer they might be a little short.
Yep, sorry.
Yeah.
I have an interesting thing next time on leasing a car versus buying it.
All right. Well, let's.
I have a personal experience on how I sorted through that whole thing and then what I decided to do. And it may surprise you. Coming up next.
Ta-da-da. Got to say.
Next week, Stacking Benjamin.
Got to say a big thank you to Laura Vanderkam for coming on the show, which is just awesome that she would do that. Check out her book. We'll have a link to it at stackingbenjamins.com on our show notes. Also, if you go to stackingbenjamins.com/Amazon and pick up the book using our link, that helps support the show. Also helps us keep on podcasting. So thanks to everybody who uses that stackingbenjamins.com/Amazon link. Thanks also to Doug for bringing down the mail. To PK for another awesome segment. And thanks to you, OG.
Thank you very much.
We'll see everybody back here on Friday with another short stack. An idea so good, Mom wanted us to give it a special show all its own. Max Nomad is here. He is going to talk about saving your computer from the zombie apocalypse. It's a great way to get into how to have good computer security, which we all need. If we're protecting our money, let's talk about computer security on Friday with Max Nomad.
This show is the property of the Free Financial Advisor, LLC, copyright 2015, and is produced by Joe Salcihi and edited by Joe and Isabella Bianca. Special thanks to Joe's mom for keeping the bikers out of the house until we were done recording.
Still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Love this article, OG. It comes from Technology Online. This guy got a divorce, and in the divorce decree, he was told that he had to give half of his assets to his wife, right?
Okay.
And he was a little unhappy with that decision, unhappy completely. In fact, in his note to his spouse, he says, here's half your stuff. By the way, say hello to, I don't remember the guy's name, like Brian, my replacement. So, and he followed the court order. He cut his car in half, gave her half. He cut the computer in half. He cut most of their possessions in half. Half the plates, half of the records. There were some REM records that she really loved. Cut them in half, gave her half. The teddy bear, chairs, a sofa, a mailbox. Some of them are valuable. A Samsung TV set, an iPhone 5, an Apple MacBook Pro, and this car.
It's fantastic. I saw a thing a couple of years ago about a divorced couple had to, he had a collector's car, 69 Stingray Corvette or something. And part of the marital estate. So judge says she gets to sell it and split the money with you. So she put it on Craigslist for a dollar.
Oh.
And goes, here you go. Here's your 50 cents.
Oh.
Sold it for a dollar. And like, you know, this is, it's online for a dollar. And the, I guess the story was the guy called and was like, yeah, I said, you know, I'm interested in Stingray, but obviously you got some prices wrong there. She goes, nope, selling it for a dollar. He's like, well, what's the catch? And she goes, it's my ex-husband's. He goes, I'll be over in a second.
Yeah.
He like runs over and gave her a dollar and she signed the title and that was that.
Oh my God.
For a dollar.
Oh yeah. My God. But she wasn't getting any of the money. Well, she was getting half the money.
Yeah, but she, this was like the same thing. Some, you know, obviously it was half of his truck too. But that was way, the satisfaction of cutting that thing in half was way worth the $10,000 of value that he lost out of the deal or whatever.
That's what one of my divorce clients told me, this joke that is, people that are divorced may find this to be in poor taste, but he thought it was funny. And he said, you know why divorce is expensive, Joe?
Why is that?